To Build a Fire, 1902, by Jack London. Read by Peter Wyant. For land travel or seafaring the world over, a companion is usually considered desirable. In the Klondike, as Tom Vincent found out, such a companion is absolutely essential. But he found out, not by precept, but through bitter experience. Never travel alone is a precept of the North. He had heard it many times and laughed, for he was a strapping young fellow, big-boned and big-muscled, with faith in himself and the strength of his head and hands. It was on a bleak January day when the experience came that taught him respect for the frost and for the wisdom of the men who had battled with it. He had left Calumet Camp on the Yukon with a light pack on his back to go up Paul Creek to the divide between it and Cherry Creek, where his party was prospecting and hunting moose. The frost was 60 degrees below zero, and he had 30 miles of lonely trail to cover, but he did not mind. In fact, he enjoyed it, swinging along through the silence, his blood pounding warmly through veins, and his mind carefree and happy, for he and his comrades were certain they had struck pay up there on Cherry Creek Divide, and further he was returning to them from Dawson with cheery home letters from the States. At 7 o'clock, when he turned the heels of his moccasins towards the Calumet camp, it was still black night, and when day broke at 9:30, he made the 4-mile cutoff across the flats, and it was 6 miles up Paul Creek. The trail, which had seen little travel, followed the bed of the creek, and there was no possibility of getting lost. He had gone to Dawson by way of Cherry Creek and Indian River, so Paul Creek was new and strange. By 11:30, he was at the forks which had been described to him, and he knew he had covered 15 miles, half the distance. He knew that in the nature of things the trail was bound to grow worse from there on, and thought that considering the good time he had made, he merited lunch. Casting off his pack and taking a seat on a fallen log, he unmittened his right hand, reached inside his shirt next to the skin, and fished out a couple of biscuits sandwiched with sliced bacon and wrapped in a handkerchief, the only way they could be carried without freezing solid. He had barely chewed the first mouthful when his numbing fingers warned him to put his mittens on again. This he did, not without surprise at the bitter swiftness with which the frost bit in. Undoubtedly, this was the coldest snap he had ever experienced, he thought. He spat upon the snow, a favorite Northland trick, and the sharp crackle of the instantly congealed spittle startled him. The spirit thermometer at Calumet had registered 60 below when he left, but he was certain it had grown much colder. How much colder, he could not imagine. Half of the first biscuit was yet untouched, but he could feel himself beginning to chill, a thing most unusual for him. This would never do, he decided, and slipping the pack straps across his shoulders, he leaped to his feet and ran briskly up the trail. A few minutes of this made him warm again, and he settled down to a steady stride, munching the biscuits as he went along. The moisture that exhaled from his breath crusted his lips and mustache with a pendant ice and formed a miniature glacier on his chin. Now and again, sensation forsook his nose and cheeks, and he rubbed them till they burned with a returning blood. Most men wore nose straps, his partners did, but he had scorned such feminine contraptions and till now had never felt the need of them. Now he did feel the need, for he was rubbing constantly. Nevertheless, he was aware of the thrill of joy, of exaltation. He was doing something, achieving something, mastering the elements. Once he laughed aloud in the sheer strength of life, and with his clenched fist defied the frost. He was its master. What he did in spite of it. It could not stop him. He was going on to the Cherry Creek Divide. Strong as were the elements, he was stronger. At such times, animals crawled away into their holes and remained in hiding. But he did not hide. He was in it, facing it, fighting it. He was a man, a master of things. In such fashion, rejoicing proudly, he tramped on. After an hour, he rounded the bend where the creek ran close to the mountainside and came upon one of the most insignificant appearing but most formidable dangers in northern travel. The creek itself was frozen solid to its rocky bottom, but from the mountain came an outflow of several springs. These springs never froze, and the only effect of the severest cold snaps was to lessen their discharge. Protected from the frost by a blanket of snow, the water of these springs seeped down into the creek. On top of the creek ice formed shallow pools. The surface of these pools, in turn, took on a skin of ice which grew thicker and thicker until the water overran and so formed a second ice-skinned pool above the first. Thus, at the bottom was the solid creek ice, then probably 6 to 8 inches of water, then the thin ice, then another 6 inches of water, and then another ice skin. And on top of this last skin was about an inch of recent snow to make the trap complete. To Tom Vinson's eye, the unbroken snow surface gave no warning of the lurking danger. As the crust was thicker at the edge, he was well towards the middle before he broke through. In itself, it was a very insignificant mishap. A man does not drown in 12 inches of water, but in its consequences, as serious an accident as could possibly befall him. At the instant he broke through, he felt the cold water strike his feet and ankles, and with a half a dozen lunges, he made the bank. He was quite cool and collected. The thing to do, and the only thing to do, was to build a fire. For another precept of the North runs, travel with wet socks down to 20 below zero. After that, build a fire. And it was 3 times 20 below and colder, and he knew it. He knew further that great care must be exercised, that with failure with the first attempt, the chance made greater for failure for the second attempt. In short, he knew that there must be no failure. The moment before a strong, exulting man, boastful of his mastery of the elements, he was now fighting for his life against those same elements. Such was the difference caused by the injection of a quart of water into a Northland traveler's calculations. In a clump of pines on the rim of the bank, the spring high water had lodged many twigs and small branches. Thoroughly dried by the summer sun, they now waited the match. It is impossible to build a fire with heavy Alaskan mittens on one's hands, so Vincent bared his, gathered a sufficient number of twigs, and knocking the snow from them, knelt down to kindle his fire. From an inside pocket he drew out his matches and a strip of thin birch bark. The matches were of the Klondike kind, sulfur matches, 100 in a bunch. He noticed how quickly his fingers had chilled as he separated one match from the bunch and scratched it on his trousers. The birch bark, like the driest of paper, burst into bright flame. This he carefully fed with the smallest twigs and the finest debris, cherishing the flame with the utmost care. It did not do to hurry things, as he well knew, and although his fingers were now quite stiff, he did not hurry. After the first quick, biting sensation of cold, his feet had ached with a heavy, dull ache and were rapidly growing numb. But the fire, although a very young one, was now a success. He knew that the little snow, briskly rubbed, would speedily cure his feet. But at the moment he was adding the first thick twigs to the fire, a grievous thing happened. The pine boughs above his head were burdened with 4 months' snowfall, and so finely adjusted were the burdens that his slight movement in collecting the twigs had been sufficient to disturb the balance. The snow from the topmost bough was first to fall, striking and dislodging the snow on the boughs beneath, and all this snow, accumulating as it fell, smote Tom Vincent's head and his shoulders and blotted out his fire. He still kept his presence of mind, for he knew how great his danger was. He started at once to rebuild the fire, but his fingers were now so numb that he could not bend them, and he was forced to pick up each twig and splinter between the tips of the fingers of either hand. When he came to the match, he encountered great difficulty in separating one from the bunch. This he succeeded in managing, however, and also by great effort in clutching the match between his thumb and forefinger. But in scratching it, he dropped it in the snow and could not pick it up again. He stood, desperate. He could not feel even his weight on his feet, although the ankles were aching painfully. Putting on his mittens, he stepped to one side so that the snow would not fall upon the new fire he was to build, and beat his hands violently against a tree trunk. This enabled him to separate and strike a second match and to set fire to the remaining fragment of birch bark. But his body had now begun to chill and he was shivering, so that when he tried to add the first twigs, his hand shook and the tiny flame was quenched. The frost had beaten him. His hands were worthless, but he had the foresight to drop the bunch of matches into his wide-mouthed outside pocket before he slipped his mittens on in despair and started to run up the trail. One cannot run the frost out of wet feet at 60 below and colder, however, as he quickly discovered. He came round a sharp bend of the creek where he could look ahead for a mile, but there was no help, no sign of help, only the white trees and the white hills and the quiet cold and the brazen silence. If only he had a comrade whose feet were not freezing, he thought. Only such a comrade to start the fire that could save him. Then his eyes chanced upon another high-water lodgment of twigs and branches. If he could strike a match, all might be well. With stiff fingers he could not bend, he got out a bunch of matches but found it impossible to separate them. He sat down and awkwardly shuffled the bunch about on his knees until he got it resting on the palm with the sulfur heads projecting, somewhat in the manner the blade of a hunting knife would project when clutched in the fist. But his fingers stood straight out. They could not clutch. This he overcame by pressing the wrist of the other hand against them and so forcing them down upon the bunch. Time and again, holding thus by both hands, he scratched the bunch on his leg and finally ignited it. But the flame burned into the flesh of his hands, and he involuntarily relaxed his hold. The bunch fell into the snow, and while he tried vainly to pick it up, sizzled and went out. Again he ran, by this time badly frightened. His feet were utterly devoid of sensation. He stubbed his toes once on a buried log, but beyond pitching him into the snow and wrenching his back, it gave him no feelings. He recollected being told of a camp of moose hunters somewhere above the forks of Paul Creek. He must be somewhere near it, he thought, and if he could find it, he might yet be saved. 5 minutes later he came upon it, lone and deserted, with drifted snow sprinkled inside the pine shelter in which the hunters had slept. He sank down, sobbing. All was over, and in an hour at best, in that terrific temperature, he would be an icy corpse. But the love of life was strong in him, and he sprang again to his feet. He was thinking quickly, what if the matches did burn his hands? Burned hands were better than dead hands. No hands at all were better than death. He floundered along the trail until he came upon another high-water lodgment. There were twigs and branches, leaves and grasses, all dry and waiting the fire. Again he sat down and shuffled the bunch of matches on his knees, got it into place on his palm. With the wrist of his other hand forced the nerveless fingers down against the bunch, and with the wrist kept them there. At the second scratch the bunch caught fire, and he knew that if he could stand the pain he was saved. He choked with the sulfur fumes, and the blue flame licked the flesh of his hands. At first he could not feel it, but it burned quickly through the frosted surface. The odor of burning flesh, his flesh, was strong in his nostrils. He writhed about in his torment, yet it held on. He set his teeth and swayed back and forth until the clear white flame of the burning match shot up, and he had applied that flame to the leaves and grasses. An anxious 5 minutes followed, but the fire gained steadily. Then he set to work to save himself. Heroic measures were necessary. Such was his extremity, and he took them. Alternately rubbing his hands with snow and thrusting them about in the flames, and now and again beating them against the hard trees, he restored their circulation sufficiently for them to be of use to him. With his hunting knife he slashed the straps from his pack, unrolled his blanket, and got out dry socks and footgear. Then he cut away his moccasins and bared his feet. But while he had taken liberties with his hands, he kept his feet fairly away from the fire and rubbed them with snow. For 3 hours he worked till the worst effects of the freezing had been counteracted. All that night he stayed by the fire, and it was late the next day when he limped pitifully into the camp on the Cherry Creek Divide. In a month's time he was able to be about on his feet, although the toes were destined always after that to be very sensitive to frost. But the scars on his hands he knows he will carry to the grave. And never travel alone, he now lays down the precept of the North.